Back on the Monday edition of Big Board Sports, 104.5 The Team, ESPN Radio, and the free 104.5 The Team app. We're the Cowper Region's home for Buffalo Bills football. Perfect segue because we're talking with our good friend Nate Geary, WGR 550 Buffalo Bills pre- and post-game friend of the station, friend of the shows. And it's always easier when we talk to him after a win, but the Bills unfortunately suffered a loss on the road against their bitter AFC East foe in the Miami Dolphins. Going to break that down in the midway point kind of the season, if you will, with Nate as he joins us here on the Monday edition. Nate, it's Michael and Vinny here in for Roger. Always appreciate a few minutes, man. How are you?
Of course, fellas.
Look, we'll begin with the here and the now and yesterday's performance against the Miami Dolphins. Vinny and I weren't trying to speak into existence by any means, but had this game labeled a trap game because you are riding the high of the win against Kansas City, your bitter rival in the Kansas City Chiefs at home. Then you head to Miami. Yes, they're having a down year. Yes, Mike McDaniel should be fired, but he's not. And you have to travel on the road and where you might be kind of overlooking your opponent, if you will. And that very well may have been the case in a 30-13 final. What are a few things that stood out in this game? And also, Nate, did you too agree with Vinny and I where you thought that this could have been a potential trap game for the Bills?
No, I did not think it was a trap game.
Okay.
I think that it was, you know, the Dolphins were probably right there with playing some of the worst football in the NFL. You know, they traded away Jalen Phillips, former first round pick, a couple of days prior. And there was conversations right before the game about how the Bills were close to potentially acquiring Jalen Waddle at the trade deadline. So, no, I didn't go into this game, especially after the way they performed against the Kansas City Chiefs. Usually that trap game is the week before a really big game, a big opponent like that Kansas City Chiefs game, not necessarily the week after. And I think, you know, what I saw was a team that, and this has happened a few times this season, you know, frankly, took their opponent, I think, a little lightly. They went into that game not playing Christian Benford, who dressed but didn't play, kind of sitting starters that I think probably could have played if it was a playoff game or a meaningful game to them. But, you know, they're sitting Taron Johnson, sitting Christian Benford, sitting, I mean, these are, you know, important players. And then you lose early in that game, Landon Jackson, who was one of their fourth defensive ends. It's a warm day. I wouldn't call it, you know, unseasonably hot in Miami. I mean, it just looked like a team that didn't have a lot of energy, didn't really bring a lot of focus, and got outworked, out-hustled, and outplayed from the very first whistle to the last one. So it was a butt-kicking I don't think a lot of people, including myself, really thought about or predicted going in, but they just got the better of them, and they exposed, I think, something that a lot of defenses have been trying to expose but really haven't gotten to. And, you know, considering that defense and the players that were playing on the back end, really, I think some concerning things you pull from this game for the Bills offensively.
Yeah, offensively too, and defensively, the run defense. I mean, Devon Achane had a field day against the Bills. 22 carries, 174 yards, 2 touchdowns. He had over 200 total scrimmage yards in the 17-point victory for the Dolphins. How concerned are you, Nate, and should Bills fans maybe be about, yes, there's health and injury issues on the defensive side of the ball, but this run defense overall after giving up the 174 yards on the ground to Devon Achane?
Yeah, you know, I think in a vacuum, if you look at the box score, you'll pull away that the Bills really struggled against the run, against the Dolphins run game. But I'll tell you, I mean, the two big runs came when that game was pretty much out of hand. That game was already over, right? I think the Bills did enough defensively to keep an offense that was, I don't know, just ineffective. And it didn't have the ability to extend drives and keep drives moving, much less big plays, right? So, I mean, holding that offense to, I mean, they turned him over on the first drive of the game, a Cole Bishop interception. And I thought for the most part through 3.5 quarters, the Bills did an okay job, a fine job of not giving up big plays in the run game. But, you know, towards the end of that game, the Bills defense was on the field for a pretty long time, and they gave up a couple of long runs that ultimately sealed the game. I'm no more worried about their run defense after last week than I was going into it. I don't think they're a good run defense. You know, getting Daquan Jones back, I think, is important. And, you know, he had to play defensive end yesterday, a couple of snaps, because that's how right now injured they are across their defensive line. So, yeah, they've got to get healthy, and they've got to get healthy quick. But I my concerns from that game, I would say about 5% of it is on the defensive side of the ball. The other 95 is on the offensive side of the ball. They don't have a Josh Allen on defense. They have a Josh Allen on offense. And for them to, you know, not be able to throw the football when they want to throw the football with a guy like Josh Allen at quarterback, to me, is a much, much bigger part of the conversation than a run defense that's been kind of this exact level for the better part of, you know, 4 or 5 seasons now.
Yeah, and you're spot on with that, Nate. And piggybacking off that with the offense, yeah. What did you make of that? Like, in games where James Cook is held to under 60 yards rushing, and, yeah, Josh Allen of the offense looked good at times, but to your point, yeah, struggled to throw the ball when they really needed it or needed a conversion or needed a big play. Who is most to blame for the offensive struggles yesterday afternoon?
Yeah, I mean, Josh Allen wears a little bit of it. Maybe not a majority, but, a good portion of it. He's missing guys. They're seeing more zone coverage this season than they have in the previous 5 seasons. Zone coverage is about taking what the defense gives you, finding guys that can wiggle free and understand when to stop their routes and when to keep them going. And right now they don't have a lot of zone beaters. They have guys that can get open against man. They've got some plans in the screen game against man, but right now this passing offense, is overly predicated on this short kind of pass game that doesn't really threaten teams over the top. And if you just watch how the Miami Dolphins defended this Bills offense, they ran a lot of zone and they were not concerned whatsoever about being beat over the top. And when you don't have a concern about being beat in big plays through the pass game over the top, you sit and you keep everything in front of you. And I thought that's what their defense did. They got physical at the line of scrimmage, and they're trying to force throws to Keon Coleman that are not there because he can't separate at all. Amongst qualifying receivers, I don't know what the threshold of routes run are. He is the worst in football in terms of qualified wide receivers in average separation score. He is not separating, and it's not that he's not separating. He's not winning those 50-50 balls. They certainly don't look like 50-50 balls, guys. They look like 30-70 balls. And like at this point, like you have to start to ask yourself is, can you have this player who cannot separate, who's not winning 50-50 balls? And the thing that really frustrates me, guys, is watching this game, it's not just him. So I don't want to make this sound like I'm isolating Keon Coleman as the only problem with this wide receiving group. It just looks like they're not enthusiastic. There's really no effort. It's a lot of jogging. It's, hey, I'm not open. Please don't throw it to me. You know, it's kind of what it looks like. And like, this is, again, not just him. On the interception in the end zone and to start the second half, you know, that ball wasn't meant to go to Dawson Knox. I think he had a short arm it a little bit and he underthrew it for the interception. But what route is Dawson Knox running? It's, I'm going to turn around and hopefully uncover and maybe the quarterback will throw me a perfect ball I can make a catch on. But I think the majority of the blame right now, guys, has to go on the offensive coordinator because they are at almost an identical spot they were with Ken Dorsey, right? Everybody looked at the numbers and said, something's not making sense. They're third in scoring and third in big plays, but they're too reliant on the downfield throws. And there wasn't enough of the run game. Now it's just been flipped on its head. Now it's, they can't function in the pass game. There's too, it's not complimentary. There is, I think, such a thing, guys, is going too far in the other direction, right? Mm. They were too focused on throwing the football down the field, big plays through the air, with frankly wide receivers that weren't separating then either, to now they've gone the other direction, the other extreme of only really being competent at running the football. Complimentary football, to me, if that's what they're aiming for, which is what Sean McDermott says all the time, they're not getting it right now just because they're running the football effectively. So, they've got some things to figure out offensively. And, you know, Dalton Kincaid, I like him. He's I don't have any insider information to tell you this, but he's probably going to the IR, guys. I mean, the hamstring injuries aren't a 1 or 2 week thing. I suspect they shut him down. And so now your most consistent pass catcher, which, by the way, is averaging about 35% of the snap share right now. Maybe you're getting Josh Palmer back. Like, I just look at their group of pass catchers and say it already was in a tough spot. Now they are in maybe the worst spot in the league in terms of pass catchers with the trade deadline already come and gone.
Well, I mean, Nate, you segue right into my next question. An elite breakdown, by the way, of last night's Bills offense against the Miami Dolphins. Nate Geary, check him out on Twitter, at Nate Geary Sports, Buffalo Bills pregame, halftime, postgame show on WGR 550. And Nate, it's Vinny here. And I mean, you mentioned the trade deadline. They didn't make any moves at the deadline this year. And, you know, there's the story going around that they had an offer for Jaylen Waddle. I can't remember what the offer was in front of me, but were you surprised that the Bills weren't more aggressive at the deadline trying to go out and especially get a playmaker on offense when they knew that it was a part of their team that they had a big hole?
Yeah, listen, I'm not telling you I think it's a lie. I'm sure the Bills were interested in, and from what the report was the Bills had offered a 2027 first and a 26 third. But the Dolphins were demanding that the 2026 first was the building block of that trade, not 2027. And that's what ultimately broke down trade talks. But here's the thing. If you're spending time, and the other thing was that they had gone aggressively after Garrett Wilson from the Jets, right?
Yep.
So you are going – now, the Bills can't help that the two biggest sellers during the trade deadline were divisional opponents, right? I mean, you can't control that. But what you can control is an understanding that, like, okay, hey, we're trying to take a big swing. And maybe they spent way too much time and energy on divisional opponents that were going to charge you an additional premium to acquire one of their good players, when a guy like Rashid Shaheed goes for a fourth and a fifth. And that's a player that I think you could have inserted in your lineup and had an impact right away. And to me, the conversation about Shaheed wasn't just that. Listen, he's not a number one receiver, okay? And I'm not here to tell you that I think trading a fourth and fifth for a guy that's not a number one receiver. But I think that's – I'm not necessarily saying that they don't need a number one receiver and he would have solved all their problems, but I think he would have solved a lot of them. And one of them, guys, is their return game. I mean, the return game is completely inept. They've got a running back in Ray Davis that doesn't have breakaway speed. And Curtis Samuel, who's never really returned kicks in the NFL. Well, Shaheed's an all-pro kick and punt returner.
Yep.
So he solves two of your problems as a guy that can take the top off the defense and also a guy that can help you in the return game. But the Bills were so focused on trying to get divisional opponents to trade with them instead of guys that were actually available on the market. To me, the leak, which is what that was, that you don't get a Sunday morning national media blitz to do PR for you. I mean, because that's what happened, right? I mean, hey, we tried really hard. We want everyone to know we tried really hard. I don't think that was the right move or play for the Bills, because I think that backfired a little bit on them yesterday. So, I'm here to tell you, you know, maybe they did, maybe they swung for the fences. But, man, I got a lot of problems if that was your solution, was you were going after a number one wide receiver or bust, when there were opportunities to make your team and your offense better, but you were too focused on, you know, trading with teams that probably were never intending to trade with you in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, even we saw Jakobi Meyers go for not that much, not, you know, a first round pick or anything. So I'm with you, Nate. You know, there were some options out there, and it certainly would have helped, you know, them in multiple aspects, like you mentioned Shaheed in the return game as well. What have been some of the most crazy overreactions you've seen through Bills Mafia, whether on Twitter or wherever, after last night's loss to the Dolphins?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, today I'm seeing on ESPN Damian Woody talking about how the window's, you know, closed and now the AFC runs through the New England Patriots. And yeah, the Patriots got a good win against the team yesterday, the Tampa Bay Bucks, that the Bills are going to be playing this week. And let me tell you, I saw a note from Aaron Schatz of, you know, he's created DVOA. And that is a Patriots offense right now that is so reliant on the big plays. I do think the Patriots are going to lose a game or two here against teams they should beat, right? They're not going to just win out. It's not how the NFL works. I mean, it's a week-to-week league, right? The Bills lose to the Falcons, but they beat the Carolina Panthers, who the Panthers then beat. It is such a week-to-week league, guys. The Patriots are going to have a game or two where you scratch your head. But right now, the success rate of their offense is solely dependent on whether or not those big plays are available to them. And if teams can figure out a way to stop those big plays, I think they're going to slow down the New England Patriots. But this idea that, you know, a guy who's, you know, Drake May in his second season, now all of a sudden the Super Bowl runs through Foxborough. I think we need to slow our roll a little bit because we haven't even seen them play a playoff game yet. So, but that's the NFL, right? It's the hot takes and the, you know, it's what is kind of what the great part about the game is, right? Is a lot of the discourse and what'll happen on the internet. But I'm not panicking, but in a way I'm saying they're at an offensive crossroads. And I don't know that, you know, the offensive coordinator is going to be able to scheme his way out of this one, because I just don't think he's got the horses to do it and change on the fly. So yeah, as someone said, you know, you either change the chef or you change the ingredients, and it's too late to change the ingredients. Mm. So, you know, I do wonder what those conversations at One Bills Drive today are going on about what's wrong with this offense.
We'll see how it plays out. Bills Buccaneers coming up on Sunday, 1 p.m. Bills currently open up as 5.5 point favorites. Both teams will be 6-3 at a big game and a pivotal one for the Buffalo Bills. He is Nate Geary. Check him out. Like Vinny said, at Nate Geary Sports on Twitter. Does great work. Halftime, pregame, postgame for WGR 550 out in Buffalo. Nate, always appreciate the time, my man. We'll talk a little bit later on in the season as it gets close to the playoff time for the Buffalo Bills. But thanks for joining us on this Monday. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Anytime, guys. Have a good day.
Thanks, you got Nate. It. You too. Nate Geary. Good stuff. Breaking it down at a high level. Hour number two, a few minutes after 11 a.m. on a Monday, November the 10th. Big Board Sports, Michael Johnson Jr., Vinny Fredericks filling in for Roger Weiland. He will be back tomorrow morning, coming back from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where his best friend from growing up, son, got married. That's why he was out Friday. You and I were in, Vinny, and then now today. But look, Siena men's basketball is off to a great start. UAlbany men's basketball, on the other hand, 0-2, but Siena is 2-0. They go to St. Bonaventure Wednesday night. We'll have Jerry McNamara on the program for his weekly segment tomorrow at 10:30. But the voice of Siena men's basketball and the New York Yankees was all over postgame on WFAN is our guy, our friend, Emmanuel Berbari. And follow him on social media on Twitter, at Berbari on Air. Plenty to get to. Emmanuel, it's always a pleasure, my man. How are you doing?
A pleasure, guys. Michael, Vinny, good to talk to you guys.
Always, yeah, man. Lots to get to. We'll start with Siena before we get in the Yankees offseason. 2-0, great start. You know, you get the win over Bryant, back-to-back double-digit wins, and then you get Brown on Friday on the road. You're obviously around this team and well in the know. What has stood out, albeit just two games through, for back-to-back double-digit wins, one at home, one on the road for GMAC and company here?
This depth was talked about a lot going into the season, and I think it showed itself so far. You got to be really happy with the production down low, which was a problem last year, and Kasmyn Goodrick, and that's Siena debut against Bryant, 22 points and 11 rebounds in 23 minutes. That was sensational. And Riley Mulvey, even though he's been a little limited coming back from the preseason injury, he's been impressive. He's drawn a lot of attention down low in his minutes on the floor. I thought he got more involved offensively in game two with some sets and alley-oop lobs to him. And then Francis Folafack, the freshman, is a beast down there. He commands a ton of attention. That's not to mention Antonio Chandler and what he could be. So the depth, particularly in the front court, has stood out. The two games, interestingly enough, they're 2-0. One, you're pretty happy with, and there were a couple of lapses where Jerry McNamara was like, okay, we could have put him away earlier, but mostly happy with that one. Game two, not happy with at all. You know, they shoot 1 of 14 from beyond the arc. They weren't crisp. They weren't clean. They still find a way to do it defensively and win that game running away on the road, which you don't take for granted. But I think the main difference in those two games, the Saints go as Justice Schoetz goes, the case last year, the case this year. He was really good in opening night, not so good in game two, but you take two wins however you get them.
Yeah, you absolutely will. It'll be a road trip to St. Bonaventure Wednesday at 7 p.m. for you, Emmanuel, and obviously this Siena men's basketball team. And how have your dealings been in year two with Jerry McNamara? Roger and I can't get enough of GMAC. Just a regular guy, straight shooter. Love the interviews and conversations with him. I can only imagine what it is like being with him on the road and having one-on-one chats with him as well, Emmanuel. But how is GMAC as a person, as the coach, just to deal with and have conversations with throughout the year?
Yeah, everything you just said, and he's as real a guy as you're going to find, truly gets it and understands what his role is as a coach at this level, leading a program. I mean, you're a program builder on top of being just the head coach and the ins and outs of night in, night out basketball. And I think everything you're experiencing and your interactions on the road, tenfold, and the type of person that he is, and really cares about everyone involved with the program. But he's also a guy I think a lot of you want guys who are no nonsense and don't get bogged down with stuff that doesn't matter. Like, he really understands what matters around the program, what he has to deal with, how to manage people, how to build relationships. And I think that's part of the reason we can talk money all we want in this day and age of basketball. That's the reason the Saints have three top starters back in the fold this year, and no other Max team has that. You know, Jerry McNamara is a people person, but he's not the type of people person who's just going to appease the college athlete at every turn. He's going to coach him hard. If you watch the way he coaches Justice Schoetz, who has earned every accolade so far since he stepped on campus, you watch the way he coaches Justice Schoetz, you understand who Jerry McNamara is.
Yep, without question. It is players clearly, ever so clearly, will run through a brick wall for him, and that is evident as well. I'm not sure how far into your prep you are or not for St. Bonaventure and this squad coming up for Siena Emanuel, but they've got a former Great Dane that we know well in Amare Marshall, but plays off the bench. They also have Woj, who's also their general manager. From what you've seen in early stages of the prep here, what will it take for Siena to get a win over a good St. Bonaventure team on the road and maybe get off to a 3-0 start and 2-0 on the road here?
Yeah, I'm very early stages of the Bonaventure prep, and I sort of love this with all the turnover in college basketball. It's like a blank canvas every single game. You're wondering, all right, this new roster, how do you get up on them? And I love that because it's like you're coming in at blindfolded and you figure out what the team is all about. That's what I'm doing with Bonaventure right now. But I know that Mark Schmidt-led teams, not only are they really well-coached, and Bonaventure's in the mix in the Atlantic 10 seemingly every year, but they're going to have that 8-10 size down low that you got to contend with. And I think Siena's gotten wrapped up on the road a lot in these games. It's not like you're always expecting them to go in there and win the Franciscan Cup, especially at the Riley Center, especially in recent years. But the Saints haven't necessarily had the bodies in the paint to contend with a team like Bonaventure. And that's not to say Bonaventure hasn't had some lethal guards over the last few years. But now I feel like the Saints do have the Atlantic 10 level size to compete with a team like Bonaventure. It's never going to be easy on the road. Riley Center, I think, is one of the more underrated atmospheres in college basketball. Really competes with almost any, despite being in the middle of only in New York. It gets loud in there. It is a real student section. It is a real college basketball atmosphere. So it's never easy to go out there and get a road win. But I think if you see more of the same that Tasman Goodrick has provided, and Riley Mulvey and Antonio Chandler steps up, and Francis Folafax, Saints will be in this game.
Emanuel, shifting gears here to the New York Yankees, of course, in the offseason, lots of high expectations after a disappointing exit in the ALDS to the Blue Jays this year, of course. Obviously, Kyle Tucker's a big name. There's, a couple big names out of Japan with Murakami, and I see now that the Yankees are favorites to sign Tatsuya Imai, which means absolutely nothing, being the favorite to sign a guy nowadays. But, I mean, realistically...
Thank you. It means absolutely squat that they're a favorite to sign him.
Yeah, we thought we'd throw it in there.
Yeah, exactly. means absolutely nothing. Yeah. But, Emanuel, I mean, realistically, what have you been hearing behind the scenes? What are your expectations for the Yankees this offseason? Do you think that, we're going to get those big expectations that a lot of fans are throwing out there?
Yeah, I was going to ask you as a follow-up when he's putting on the Dodger uniform.
Well played.
Time will tell on that front, but I got to say, I do expect a lot of the key core pieces to be in place, sort of like it was last year. The Yankees had to pivot to Plan B after the Juan Soto departure, and they did so. I understand they didn't go as far as they did in 2024, but in the regular season, they replicated 94 wins without Juan Soto, and it came with a lot of the younger core guys. Now, Anthony Volpe, it's well documented. He did not have the year he wanted to. Austin Wells, behind the plate, did not have the year he wanted to, despite some big moments here and there. You have young pieces in Jason Dominguez and Spencer Jones coming up through the ranks. I think a lot of these areas on the diamond, including Ryan McMahon, who was traded for at the deadline, Ben Rice is probably your everyday first baseman now, they're solidified. So absent a trade we don't expect, and I think Brian Cashman is always good for one of those in offseason, we look up and we see, Caleb Durbin for Devin Williams. That's just one example recently. But Caleb Durbin and Nestor Cortez for Devin Williams, didn't see that coming. Now the Yankees have a back-end reliever those seem to pop up every single offseason, so I think we're good for one of those. I'm not sure what that will be. I'd be really intrigued with, like, a Stephen Kwan from Cleveland. Ooh. If you can make him your left fielder. Nice. And add some balance and contact.
Yeah.
To the top of your order. That would really interest me, but I'm not sure. I'm not in that room. I think they probably have a big board of guys that they're attacking from the trade market to the free agent pool, and I think the improvements will be there, but they'll be subtle. We're not talking about groundbreaking material when a lot of the core pieces are in place for this team.
Do you see them bringing back guys like Cody Bellinger, Trent Grisham, some of these, you know, free agents? I know Luke Weaver is a bullpen guy that had a disappointing end to last year but showed signs in the playoff run 2 years prior. Do you see them bringing back some of these guys or go elsewhere?
Luke Weaver is really interesting. I think that would have to be at the right price, especially with the way things ended, because what's his market now? Probably after 2024, you're looking at a guy who's getting top-end reliever money. After this year, our team's looking at him like, oh, there's a reclamation project once again. I'm not sure. Maybe it's somewhere in between. Mm. I think the likelihood of that type of reunion is a little lessened with what happened and the way things ended. Trent Grisham just got the qualifying offer, which I wasn't always so sure was a foregone conclusion. He got $22 million and the qualifying offer. And I would not be shocked if he accepts that qualifying offer, right? He got on the open market, maybe he gets a 3-4 year deal elsewhere and he wants that security. But is he getting $22 million per on that 3 or 4 year deal? I don't think so. I mean, that is shattering money for a guy like Trent Grisham, who, you know, with respect to him and the season he had, a career year, and they were clutch home runs. They were all meaningful home runs if you're watching the Yankees night in and night out. So you love what Trent Grisham did. Do we actually expect him to replicate that over the long term? That's why the Yankees are probably thinking if he takes it, 1 year stopgap in center field, hey, you rolled the dice in that ballpark that he could do it again. I think that's really fascinating because that will set the tone for the entire offseason. Yeah. Maybe if Trent Grisham bites and takes that qualifying offer, you don't have Cody Bellinger back because maybe they use left field as, all right, Dominguez or Jones, may the best man win. Who knows? I think that's possible if Grisham takes it.
On to the, well, it's already been, in the midst of the Yankees offseason winter meetings coming up, and this will be fun to follow, and 2 games into the Siena men's basketball season as well. Best time of the year when we can talk Yankees and Siena with our guy, Emmanuel Barbari. Emmanuel, always a pleasure. Have fun with the St. Bonaventure game, and we'll be back in touch throughout the season and beyond, but always appreciate the time, my man. All the best.
Of course. Great to have you guys. Appreciate it.
You got it.
Yep. Thanks, Emmanuel.
Emmanuel Barbari. Welcome back to Big Board Sports. Michael Johnson Jr., Vinny Fredericks in for Roger Weiland on this Monday. Connor Pierce is across the glass. Always love to talk some Liberty League college football, local college football, every Monday. And in this time slot is the head coach of the Union football team, the Garnet Chargers, of course, and John Drock. And he joins Vinny and I for a few minutes for his weekly spot every Monday at 11:30, also up on our podcast after the show, just in case the Union supporters miss it. Coach, always a pleasure. Happy Monday. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. How are you?
All good. All good. Thanks. And hey, well, this is you're off to a phenomenal start in the Liberty League. A perfect 6-0, 7-2 overall. We'll preview the Dutchman Shoes game that'll be at your place a little bit later on in this interview. But first, you survived 14-10 over Rochester, and I saw season low 217 yards of offense, but you still get the win. What does that say about your squad facing a little adversity in a tough Rochester team, but still being able to pull out the W?
Yeah, it's a good football team. You know, I mean, I think we knew that going into the week, that going to their place on senior day was going to be a tough game. Everybody that they've played this year has been a really close game, Hobart in overtime and Ithaca in a one possession game. So we knew we were going in a place that they were going to be a really good football team defensively. They did some really good things, had some good guys on the linebacker level, and they did some good things in the secondary as well. So had some opportunities to be able to make some plays, didn't really capitalize as much as we probably should have on the offensive side of the ball, and then the defense really stepped up. I thought defense and special teams did a great job, created 4 turnovers on the defensive side of the ball, sealed the game at the end of the game with 2 picks. So overall, it was a good team win. You know what I mean? I think when you get into this time of year and you're getting down to the nitty-gritty of it, is you got to have really great team football, and the offense has to come to play, the defense has to come to play, and the special teams has to come to play. Overall, though, I think that our special teams units and our defensive units did a fantastic job.
Boy, you nailed that, and piggybacking off of it, Coach Drock, for just a second, I mean, the 4 turnovers, the 3 picks and the fumble, and the one, like you mentioned, alluded to on the final drive. What was working that you saw from your defensive group, only holding, it, like you said, a good Rochester football team to 10 points? And obviously, when you win the turnover battle, 9 times out of 10, a lot of times, you know, this is coached football, you'll have a good chance of winning that football game too. too.
Yeah, no doubt. I think that we did some things coverage-wise to be able to keep the football in front of us for the most part and force some tight windows. I thought our D-line did a great job of getting pressure in the quarterback's face and made him probably make some throws that he really didn't want to have to make at that point.
Yeah.
And then we really changed up the looks. You know what I mean? I think that, that's a real key to our success is we're able to be very, very multiple-fronted because we have so many really smart kids and we can do some things on the back end with our shell as well, changing things up and changing that picture for a quarterback so he doesn't really know what he's going to get on a snap-to-snap basis. And that little hesitation or that change of look can create the most turnovers, and our defensive coaching staff did a great job of doing that. We did make them one-dimensional. I think they only ran for 41 yards in the day, average like 1.2 yards per carry or something like that. So from that standpoint, making a team one-dimensional is what you kind of try to be able to do. And yes, they threw the ball for, I think they had 200 or 300 yards passing, but at the end of the day, when it got close and they needed to run the football, they couldn't run the football when they got in the red zone. I think that was the difference in the football game.
Yeah, without question. Look, let's just statistically, if you look at the box score, it wasn't your quarterback, Patrick Lennigan's best game, but he made the plays when he needed to. And what does it say about him? We know he's such a great leader on and off the field, but what did you make of Patch's performance overall in the quarterback position? Right, yeah, the stats don't jump out at you, but you still get the victory. Still unbeaten in the Liberty League.
Still led us in rushing and had two touchdowns. And so from that standpoint, I thought he did a solid job. There were some things. We had the one fumble early as we were kind of getting in the red zone. And then we had a couple passes that we weren't able to kind of connect on throughout the course of the game. But overall, he did a great job of managing the football game. He protected the football in the second half. And at the end of the day, that was the biggest difference. He made a couple big plays when we needed those big plays. The one touchdown pass came on 3rd and 12, I want to say, and did a great job of reading the defense and getting the ball where it needed to be. So, you know, in those clutch situations, you know, you want to have the guy with the ball in his hand, and he did a great job of leading us in that capacity. We'll watch the film and grow from it. And as we kind of build up into this week of a really good football team in RPI.
Coach, of course, next week, Dutchman Shoes game at 1 o'clock at home. And not just a rivalry game, but also a game that has some playoff implications, you know, win and get in against RPI. So what do you want to see out of your guys, you know, throughout the week in practice and leading up to RPI next week? What do you think it's going to take to get a win and stay undefeated in Liberty League play?
I think it's going to take all three phases of the game really clicking. You know, it's a good football team. You got to come with your best offensively, defensively, and special teams wise. I mean, they're good in all three facets. They lead a lot of statistical categories in all three facets. So it's going to take us playing our game. We want to be able to control, obviously, the football, limit our turnovers, then make some big plays on the defensive side of the ball. If we can do that, I think that's going to put us in a good situation to win. But it can't just be one unit that stands out. It's going to have to be all three that kind of play together and capitalize on the opportunities that each one provides. Mm-hmm. When we get a short field, we got to go down and score. Yep. When we get a turnover, we got to capitalize on that. All those things of playing together are going to be big in the overall outcome of that football game.
Coach, how much are you looking forward to the atmosphere? We know the rivalry's there, and you being in your second year, being a part of this Dutchman Shoes game, too. Down at your place, how much are you looking forward to the fans showing out? And just a little bit of extra juice, extra motivation to finish the regular season going against your better local rival in RPI.
Yeah, no question. I think that obviously playing for a conference championship and then obviously playing for the Shoes is, you know, where you want to be at the end of the year. And, you know, our guys put a lot of work in to be in this position, starting all the way back last December. There's kind of a year's worth of work that's kind of gone into this. And I'm sure the same thing is true for them. You know, I mean, I think at the beginning of the year, we were picked to finish fifth in the league. I don't think we got a lot of respect coming into the year at all. And so being in this position, I think, is a credit to our players' work ethic and their drive and their passion. And I think you'll see that come Saturday.
Further proving how much those preseason polls really mean, Coach. I love that you threw that in there at the end. Hey, listen, best of luck. It's been fun following your team all throughout with Roger through the regular season. Good luck. It's going to be a great game. Should be an outstanding atmosphere again. That's a 1 p.m. kick at Frank Bailey Field on the campus, of course, of Union. And he is Coach John Drock, unbeaten so far in the Liberty League. Coach, all the best. Good luck on Saturday. Roger and I will be back to recap it with you on Monday at 11:30. But thanks so much, as always.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
You got
Thanks,
it. Coach. John Drock. Back on Big Board Sports, hour number three here. Michael Johnson Jr., a.k.a. MJ Vinny Fredericks, in for Roger Weiland. Connor Pierce is across the glass. We continue our conversation on the Liberty League, and now it's time for the RPI portion of that with their head football coach, Ralph Isernia, joins us to kick off, if you will, hour number three. Coach, always a pleasure to be talking to you on a Monday here. How you doing?
Doing good. Thanks for having me on.
You got it, Coach. Always a pleasure. And, you know, obviously Roger and I, Vinny and I, too, rooting heavily for you guys to win over the weekend, just like with Union. I think the layers would have been even, as if the Dutchman Shoes game needs any more layers, Coach, added onto it with both teams coming in with an unbeaten conference record. But you guys battled and fall just short on the road, or at home rather, against Ithaca and the Bombers. 5-1 in the Liberty League, 7-2 overall. Still been a great season. What were some of your big takeaways in the nail biter of a game against Ithaca, Coach?
Yeah, we knew the type of game that it was going to be. It was going to be a physical game, and one of the things that we wanted to do was to get off to a good start. And we had a long 80-yard run for a touchdown from Caden White. I think it was the second play of the game that put us out on top. And we knew it was going to be a four-quarter battle. Playing against a really good team, well coached. They threw a lot of looks at you defensively, and then offensively, they were bringing in some extra offensive linemen to run the football, and they had a good dual threat quarterback, and he could throw the ball pretty good, and they had some guys that he hit that were open, and I was proud of our guys who were battling back and getting to a point where we blocked a punt there and took it into the end zone, and we decided to go for two and go for a win right there. Having a little bit of time left over, if we didn't get it. So throw just out of the reach. But like I said, I was proud of guys, the way that we battled and handled some adversity and we're obviously, onto this week and the Shoes game.
Yeah, we'll get to that in just a sec there, Coach. 193 on the ground for your engineers team, and only 92 yards through the air. Was it defensively, schematically, what Ithaca was looking at you, made it a little bit difficult for you guys to throw the football? Or was that game plan and mindset of attack was, hey, we want to pound the rock, we want to run the football heavy, that's what we want to do first and foremost here?
Yeah, that was one of the things that we looked at. They were a team that weren't giving up a lot of yards in the run game, so we had to fashion some things where we can get numbers, or if they had an extra number in the box, then it was up to our running back to try to make a miss. And it was leaning on the run game. They gave us some looks defensively that took away some of our routes, and we've been fairly balanced with run and pass, maybe a little bit more pass. So I think they were focused a little bit more on the pass and instead of the run game, but that was something that fed us the entire game, was being able to run the football and get into manageable scenarios on second and third down.
Coach, obviously it's hard to replicate special team success week to week because it's so sporadic when special teams gets the chance to make big plays, but obviously you get the big punt return touchdown in the fourth quarter yesterday, and I mean, obviously you'd like to see more stuff like that next week against Union in the Dutchman Shoes game, but and as far as the special teams go, how do you feel about the way your team performed and kind of took matters into their own hands when other aspects of the game and of the team were struggling a little bit?
Yeah, that's one of the things that we do focus on. We focus on a lot, and a lot of programs, kind of pay lip service to special teams. They say it's a third of the game, but they don't practice it a third of the time. So, we practice it a ton, and it's something that we hang our hat on as key plays. That one rep mentality. On special teams, you out there for one play, and that's the only play. And you might be waiting six or seven plays to get back on the field. So we've got to make that one rep count. And our guys have done a good job with that, with kick returns for touchdowns, punt returns, and getting us really good field position, and where the offense doesn't have to drive the whole length of the field, and your playbook winds up being wide open as far as that's concerned. So special teams is something that we take obviously very seriously here. Yeah. and we practice it a lot, and we're hoping that becomes one of the major factors in a close game.
Without question, Coach, and I have a funny feeling, speaking of a close game, this one's going to be close and competitive on Saturday in the annual Dutchman Shoes game. What number is this for you, Coach? You've been with RPI for a while. What number Dutchman Shoes game is this for you?
I think it's number 12.
How bad?
I think it's number 12 here.
12.
So,
oof.
Wow. Yeah. So it's, it's a great game. It's the oldest rivalry in New York State. We're only separated by about 30 minutes, drive time. You know, depending, you know, it could be 33, 35, depending on traffic, time to go and stuff like that. You know, it's one of those things where, you know, we're so close in proximity that when, you know, kids come for visits, whether it's to Union or to RPI, they're always making the other visit to the other school because we're so close. So, you know, you get to know the rosters, you get to know the guys that, you know, maybe you didn't get that are playing for their team and stuff like that. But, you know, Union's they're a complete football team from offense, defense, special teams, extremely well coached.
Yeah.
They've got guys in the right positions. You know, schematically on defense, they're gonna show you a whole bunch of different looks and get out of it, and they run to the football. And you know, offensively, they've got you know, probably the best quarterback in the league, a guy that can spin it and a guy that can go the distance in the run game. And you know, they're the complete package. Absolutely.
All right, Coach, before we let you go, speaking of that, what are a few keys for you, for your engineers team for you and year number 12 and the 12th Dutchman Shoes game to get a victory and retain the trophy here on Saturday?
Well, I think the first thing is not allowing the atmosphere and the trophy to be the sole focus of what you're trying to do. And you know, we pride ourselves on being one play warriors, and that's exactly what we have to do. We have to play it one play at a time and just focus on that one play, that one assignment, that one technique, and not get into, all right, what if this happens, what if that happens, and your mind starts to wander, and then you lose focus. And sure, you know, they're a team that can go the distance. So, you know, that's a major thing for our guys, because I know in this game it's one of those things where you get so amped up for the game. And you know, especially over there, it's going to be an electric atmosphere, no pun intended. But you know, that's you know, it's a great game, and it's one of the great things about college football.
Yes, it is. Can't wait. That's a 1 p.m. kick, and if you don't have any plans on Saturday, head over to Union College to see the Engineers take on the Garnet Chargers. Oldest rivalry, like Coach Acerny has said, in New York State for college football. RPI Union, 1 p.m. kick. Coach, best of luck. We always appreciate the time. Love talking some local college football, Liberty League. And Roger and I will be back on Monday to recap the game with you. But best of luck, and we'll talk next week, Coach. Thanks for your time, as always.
All right. Thanks, guys.
You got it.
Thanks,
Coach. Coach Acerny. All around good guy, just like Coach Drock. And man, 12 years, he's really good coach. He's been at RPI. He's seen these coaches go. We've had Coach Poppy on, you know, now Coach Drock for a couple seasons. Coach Poppy now at Columbia, the former Union football head coach. This is going to be a great game.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, also, sir, if I wasn't on the call for you, Albany Towson, I'm going to probably have that up, you know, all, down to the set. That this is a legitimate game, big rivalry. RPI won last year 27-7 at RPI. So they're looking to retain the trophy. But Union had a down year last year. Union's really good this year in Jarrock's second year. So I know Raj, when he comes back, and you know, he's going to be excited for this game. I am too. Gets no better. It's an awesome trophy, too, if you look. It's an old-school trophy, like the old, you know, you got the red for RPI and the garnet for Union. If you haven't seen the Dutchman Shoes game, winner gets the Dutchman Shoes trophy, RPI at Union, Saturday at 1 p.m.